With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
I once asked Jim Watson, I said, what was the most important thing you ever did in your life? And he said, well, first thing he said, well, not the double helix, because the double helix was inevitable. Somebody was going to find it.
How we go about communicating such disruptive technologies, and if you see history as a tool for doing that.
Well, I think it can be. I mean, although historians tend to spend their time saying, you know what, this is exactly what they said last time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to STEMcast's special series, where we explore the intersection of research and various other fields. Today, I have the pleasure to be speaking with Professor Matthew Cobb. Professor Cobb was a professor of zoology at the University of Manchester, where his research focused on genetic and developmental factors involved in insect chemical communication. So you guys can think of olfaction and pheromones. Beyond these scientific interests, Professor Cobb is also a renowned science historian, being awarded the 2025 Wilkins-Bernal Medawar Medal by the Royal Society, appearing on various BBC programs, and authoring several books that we will touch on today. Professor Cobb, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thanks a lot for inviting me, Sabrina. It's good to be here.
I'd like to begin by asking you about your research interests. What first captured your interest and curiosity in science, in insect chemical communication and its evolutionary and genetic bases?
Well, that came a bit later. The starting point, and I can pinpoint it quite exactly, is when I was exactly your age. I was in my second year as a psychology student at the University of Sheffield. And in those days, this was basically before neuroscience existed as a term. And my psychology department did all sorts of things, from computer modeling of vision to structure of the brain in rats, and visual processing in rats, all sorts of things, basically stuff that you'd now call neuroscience. We also learned about Freud, so it was a bit odd. But I was in my second year, and I read a little article in New Scientist, which is a British weekly science magazine, which described this is in 1975, so before the internet, when the world was in black and white, no smartphones, and it described a recent paper that was published in PNAS about some researchers in America who had made a Drosophila fly stupid. They made it unable to learn. They had created a mutation, which they called Dunce, because Drosophila mutations always have silly names. And because of the way they made it, the chemicals they used to make it, they could be pretty confident that this was a single base pair mutation. And I read that and I thought, my God, that's amazing. You could not only can a fly learn, I mean, that's pretty cool, but you can actually use genetics to get at the biochemistry of something as complicated as learning. And so I decided there and then that's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to study. And, you know, whatever it is, 50 years on, here I am still basically in that world. Now, I was one of the main things I think young people need to understand is that our careers and our future and our promotions are partly based on talent, but to be honest, not really, because anybody who gets to university is pretty talented. People who do PhDs, perhaps a bit more, not necessarily. Above all, what counts in academic careers, including up to the level of professor and beyond, is luck. And I was lucky because, as it happened, I had no idea. I was at Sheffield, this was the only place in the UK at the time that was studying Drosophila behavior genetics. And about 2 weeks later, we had a practical in which we did, wasn't any very interesting behavior. It was to do with the flies shaking when they had been etherized, so anesthetized, and different mutations altered the way that shaking happened. And we now know that, in fact, that's all to do with calcium-potassium channels in the fly's neurons. We didn't know at the time. It's just a weird kind of phenotype. So I meant that, amazingly, I was able to carry on studying that. I could ended up doing a PhD in Sheffield on this thing that had caught my imagination a few years earlier. I initially studied learning. That didn't go too well, so we dropped that and turned to something that we were certain would work, which was a rather descriptive stuff about the fly's courtship behavior. And this was before anything was known about pheromones in flies. And so it was simply a description of their behavior. My colleagues, my supervisor had previously studied the sounds produced by flies when they're courting before they mate. And I looked at several different species. And then eventually, after a postdoc, a bit of a sidetrack, I ended up being suggested in 1983. The person who was pioneering the work on Drosophila pheromones, I met him at a conference, a man called Jean-Marc Jalon, who's French. And he said, well, why don't you see if you can get a grant from the Royal Society to come work with me for a year? And so I was able to do that and went in 1984 to a place called Gif-sur-Yvette, which is just on the outskirts of Paris. And I ended up staying in Paris for 18 years, which was not what I expected. And it was during that time that I actually really got interested in studying pheromones and understanding how they shaped the interactions between flies, which is what I was interested in. Then eventually after a few years, we started looking at olfaction, and we primarily used larvae, which are really simple and stupid and just interested in smelling because they just want to eat. So they're interested in food, so they will just move towards a smell they like, move away from a smell they don't like. And so that's basically from about 1987, 88, I was working on primarily on larvae, but still publishing a bit on pheromones in flies.
And the Drosophila larvae has followed you your entire career. I mean, 21 olfactory receptor neurons, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And that can encompass an entire career, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, we still don't understand how it works. I mean, yeah. So to give you an example, so humans have about 4 million smell cells, which are grouped into roughly 400 types. And of course, it's very difficult to, say, record from those cells. You can't put electrodes into these cells, which are high at the dangle down through the base of your skull. Whereas a Drosophila maggot has just 21, as you rightly say. They're all different. And because this is Drosophila, you can do all sorts of astonishing things with the genetics. And you can make flies or Drosophila larvae that just have one functioning smell cell. So you could then record from that cell and you know exactly what it is and see how it responds to different odors.
I mean, your career, it's really interesting to see how a story of a dumb fly jumpstarted the scientific career. And so I was wondering if the storytelling aspect contributed to you putting on the hat of science historian, but historian as a whole as well. I see you have very broad interests.
Well, yeah, I'd always been interested in history. I mean, I did a very in the UK, we have what are called A levels. So you do three subjects at high school. They generally tend to be either science or humanities. And I was very odd. I did English, history and biology, which means that I have a Bachelor of Arts, not a Bachelor of Sciences. So that's why I studied Freud. The psychology department was divided into those who'd study, who had had done chemistry, and I didn't. And so I couldn't do that strand. So I had to do them all. I mean, we did the same stuff about, you know, computer models of vision and rat brains and stuff like that. So I'd always been interested in history because I studied English, history and biology. And what actually prompted it was when I was writing, one of the things you have to do as an academic is to write a big review. Always at some point, you want to write a big review of your topic about how it's changed over the decades and what the perspectives are. So I was writing in mid 1990s an article called What and How Do Maggots Smell? So basically, it was a survey of everything that we knew at the time in the late 90s about maggots of all kinds of fly maggots, how they smell, what the odors they responded to, and also the structure of their nervous system, their olfactory nervous system. And one of the things that I ended up doing, I kept on seeing these references to articles from a book from the 18th century. And I, you know, so one of the things, you have to trace everything back to show you've read everything, right? And I kept on thinking, well, that's going to be rubbish. There's no way that any, these things are tiny. I mean, the maggots are tiny and the noses are tiny. It's impossible that anything important about the structure of the nose of a maggot, which is what I was interested in, could have been done at that period. As it happened, I was in Paris. I was right next door to the Museum d'Histoire Naturelle, so I could go to their library and say, there's this book here by this character called Schramadam, who Dutchman, can I have it, please? And they brought out these two big, thick, leather-bound volumes and plonked it on the desk. And one volume was just in Latin and Dutch, and I couldn't understand any of it. And then the other volume was similarly in Latin and Dutch, but at the back it had plates. It had drawings, astonishing drawings. And I opened it, and I was just amazed. And in particular, what obviously caught my eye was the drawing of the nervous system of the brain of a maggot, which wasn't a Drosophila maggot, but it's about the same size, the species it's from. This man, who, as it turned out, this book was published in 1737, 1738. In fact, it had been, the work had been done in the 1670s. He died in 1680. So it was even more ancient than I thought. And I was just astonished that this man I'd never heard of had done such amazing work. To cut a very long story short, I ended up writing, I got quite obsessed with him, and I wrote various academic articles and popular articles about him around about 25 years ago, about the turn of the century. And finally ended up, when I came back to the UK, ended up writing a book about his work and the work of other researchers on what we would call reproduction, but at the time was simply called generation, how new life appears. So I wrote a book about that as well.
Is it the egg and sperm race and the life story?
Or the egg and sperm race, hard to get hold of under that title. You can generally find hardback copies of it going very cheap under the US title, which was Generation. It did get reviewed twice by The Lancet, a British medical journal, under each title. And both reviews were good, but nobody noticed it was the same book.
But you see how, so a lot of people can get access to these scientific stories via more popular books. Sometimes, like for me, for example, I came across one of your works through a Nature essay, and it was about the 1975 Asilomar meeting. And by reading the essay, it really made me question the effect that major historical events have on public opinion, on the discoveries in life science, for example. So I'm thinking about Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, or, you know, when we discovered recombinant DNA and people were thinking of using it for insulin, all these things. I was wondering what your take on how public opinion evolved over the last century and a half, and how you think communication like these really shaped it.
Yeah, that's a very big question. I mean, because although my interests, and as I gather, the primary interests of many of your listeners aren't biomedical, the public is obviously very, very attached to cures for disease. So probably the greatest breakthrough in health in the 20th century was the discovery of antibiotics. Penicillin was discovered by Alexander Fleming on a windowsill, and all that's true. On the other hand, going from that to actually having something you could take as a pill, that was really complicated and involved other people who did win the Nobel Prize for actually delivering it. But what that did was two things. Firstly, it reinforced, I think, the image of the lone genius stumbling over things, which, you know, does happen. You know, I mean, Schramadam was a pretty lone, weird bloke. Alexander Fleming was nowhere near as weird as Schramadam, that's for sure. But I think the other thing is that people realize that things are more complicated, or things, it becomes apparent that things are more complicated. So fairly obviously, in the case of antibiotics, from the very outset, people, including the people who were developing them, became very concerned about the possibility of resistance developing. And that is where we've been for the last 70 odd years, and we're now at a bit of an impasse because we don't have new antibiotics. None of the big pharmaceutical companies are developing them. So that evolutionary insight, which is kind of obvious to an evolutionary biologist, if you put on big selection pressure on an organism, it will find a way of fighting back. As Leslie Orgel, who was Francis Crick's close friend, said, he more or less said, evolution is smarter than you are. It's always going to find a way around, you know. That, I think, has, through public engagement and popularization, has led people to be a bit more aware of the complexities of discoveries that they may want to embrace and think, well, this is marvelous. And then actually people saying, well, you know, actually it's really complicated and it can have untoward consequences, like, you know, going to the doctor because you've got a virus and saying, give me antibiotics, you know, which is a bad idea because the antibiotics won't do anything to a virus.
And now, especially when you have such disruptive fields, so I'm thinking of biotechnology, or a lot of your books talk about genetic engineering, how we go about communicating such disruptive technologies, and if you see history as a tool for doing that.
Well, I think it can be. I mean, although historians tend to spend their time saying, you know what, this is exactly what they said last time. I mean, not in a kind of smart way, but just saying, look, you know, things haven't really developed. So, I mean, this actually happened. We've recently, in February, we had a meeting, the 50th anniversary of this Asilomar meeting you mentioned earlier on, which is when the about 150 molecular geneticists from mainly from the USA, but from around the world, got together to try and work out how you could use recombinant DNA safely, what safety protocols should be applied. And scientists love this because it's an example of self-regulation. You know, the clever people who developed this technique have come up with ways that history has shown turn out to be fairly safe. I mean, nothing bad has happened yet in this field. And so we had this meeting to commemorate this 50 years on, and it was people were discussing the recent developments, synthetic biology, mirror life, all sorts of things like that. And many of the arguments over how dangerous is this and so on, and what can we do, were being exactly the same as we heard 50 years ago, including rhetoric. Like in 1975, they were discussing a particular kind of E. coli that was being used, and one of the British delegates to Asilomar got up and said, well, you know, I can drink this, no problem. And then somebody was talking about synthetic life, and they said exactly the same thing. You know, well, they didn't have a sample, but they said, you know, I can get a sample of my synthetic bacterium and I can swallow it, and it's not going to do me any harm. So the historians were kind of chortling at this, because it was just so staggering that, you know, nothing much had changed. Many of the same arguments were being repeated. So I think it's very useful for the problem is that, I mean, scientists are interested in history, but they generally like the history that you know, either sings the praise of great men, which historians tend not to do these days. They tend to produce a more complicated picture. It wasn't the case in the past. And also they want this, you know, they only really hear what they want to hear, right, as scientists, because they've got an obligation, you know, especially if they're mixed up with some startup or whatever, then they're very, very focused on outcomes. Whereas people saying, well, you know what, last time, blah, 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 that doesn't generally go down too well. So I think if you counter their own assumptions, by saying, look, actually, you know, this version of history that you learned is quite different, that can cause problems. Even, for example, when people have very well-meaning views. So, for example, one of the things that I've been doing recently is working on the story of the discovery of the double helix of DNA, where everybody knows that Watson and Crick stole Rosalind Franklin's data. And they know that because Jim Watson effectively says it in The Double Helix, which is this brilliant page-turning account of the discovery, except that's not true, right? And what reads like a real story is a novelized account. And together with my colleague, Nathaniel Comfort, you know, we've shown that, in fact, it was certainly the version that Watson tells is not true. And this is this has led to a substantial kickback from many people who think that because we're showing that it was complicated and it wasn't this photograph 51 business had absolutely nothing to do with the discovery of DNA. Crick never saw it. And if you think about it, this photograph, which Watson said, my God, it means that DNA is a helix. Why didn't Franklin realize that? Because she was very smart and she just put it in a drawer for all sorts of complicated reasons we haven't got time to go into. So my point being that it's not the historical truth, but something that's closer to what happened, which is complicated and messy and suggests that Franklin kind of, you know, wasn't really bothered about the whole thing. That gets a lot of flack from people who think that these were two sexist pigs who stole her data. When you say, how do you know that? They say they either don't know, but the only source for that story is Jim Watson's book, which is novelized. It's a novelized account. So there's things in there that aren't true. Francis Crick did not go into the Eagle Pub and said, we have discovered the secret of life. And Watson has now admitted that he made it up for dramatic impact. So the thing is, people, you know, scientists are very concerned about how they know what they know, what philosophers call epistemology. How do you know what you know? Well, I know it because I did this experiment. How do you know it wasn't a different factor? I did a control, blah, blah, blah. So without knowing it, they're doing this. They have an epistemology. But when you ask them about history, how do you, you know, they don't question what they've read on the internet, internet jokes. You know, what did Watson and Crick discover in 1953? Rosalind Franklin's data, ba-boom, which is a good joke, but it's just not true. And they don't question how they know things, right? So I think that's one of the things that historians can try and do is get scientists in particular, but also the public. Well, how do I know this is true? I've read it. I might have read Watson's book. More likely it's just in the air. But how do I know that's true? And what if it's not? How does that alter what I think about those events and about the people involved in it? I'm not saying Watson and Crick were blameless. They did act in an unscrupulous way. They should have talked to Franklin about what they were doing. But documents we've discovered suggest very strongly that she basically said, you can talk to your pal, their boss, in fact, a guy called Max Perutz. He can tell you all about it, all about the work that she'd been doing. Because she was abandoning DNA work by this stage. She was
fascinating. Like the idea of... how do we know what we know in science is a very, it's crucial. It's the question that everybody has in the back of their mind when they are doing science. But you're absolutely right in a lot of people not questioning the how do we know what we know in terms of what we read about history and historical facts. And do you think your role as a researcher kind of influenced how you went about doing science history research and vice versa?
I'm not sure it was that, but I mean, what me and Nathaniel Comfort did, we were both in Cambridge in 2022 in the summer, and we decided we'd go to Churchill College to see the Rosalind Franklin archives. She was not at Churchill College, but they have most of her archives. What we decided, well, because historians are terrible fetishists, they want to touch the original papers, right? It wasn't all the original. Some of them were very high quality photocopies because they kept them, you know. But what it meant we did was we sat together and we looked at Franklin's notes and we tried to understand what she was writing. I mean, neither of us she was a very smart physical chemist. That's not either of us. Nathaniel used to be a molecular biologist. I'm a neuroscientist of kinds. But we understand enough about the technique so that 70 years on, we could, you know, say this is what she's getting at. And that actually gave us a huge insight because we were using our scientific knowledge and thinking, trying to see what the steps in her thinking were. And that led us to realize why she was interested she wasn't interested in this, what's called the B form, which is the humid form of DNA. She was a chemist. And therefore, if a chemist works out a structure, they need the crystalline form. They need the purest form, because that's the ultimate, you know, that's the thing you need. So she was given and was very happy to be working on what's called the A form, which is very low humidity. And that produced some really complicated really complicated X-ray images, and she couldn't interpret it. And when Crick eventually saw her data after the structure had been discovered, he said, well, I'm glad I didn't see all those data, because that is very confusing. But she decided, because of this, that the A-form was not did not have a helical structure. She, like everybody else, accepted, despite what you might read in Watson's book, accepted that the B-form had helical structure. And by reading her notes, we could see that the chemist's mind working. Yes, the crystal, that's what I want. And she says, you know, when it gets humid, then the order disappears. It just disintegrates. The stuff dissolves. So she's kind of dismissing what a biologist might go, wait a minute, this stuff works inside cells. Cells are really, really wet. Maybe, you know, you can be snarky with Rosalind going back 70 years. Maybe you should think about that, eh? But she's not, because she's a chemist. She's got a different mindset. And we were actually able to see this in her notes. And that was fascinating. I think if we hadn't been scientists, we might not have made that grasp what was going on in her head. That then explains why she gets sidetracked, and why she puts this B-form image in a drawer, because she thinks it's just an epiphenomenon. It's just disintegrating. It's not interesting. The structure, the crystal, that's the purest form possible, except it's not biologically real.
It's incredible to see how far we've gone from looking at the crystal structure and the humid structure of DNA all the way till now. We have CRISPR, we have genetic editing, sequencing and bridge RNAs. I might divert a bit, but to talk a bit about your book, As Gods, A Moral History of the Genetic Age, it's a nice topic, especially after we talked about the discovery of the structure. Your book touches a bit on this tug of war between scientific advancement and ethical concerns. And you've also mentioned previously that we had the 50th anniversary of the Asilomar meeting. I was wondering if in that meeting or throughout recent years, you see a difference in how scientists approach this tension when trying to accomplish what you've previously called great biology.
Well, some do and some don't. I think an awareness of the ethical issues is much, much stronger. Mm-hmm. I mean, what has happened around the world since then in terms of, you know, discoveries of terrible scandals about mistreatment of often ethnic minorities who have been manipulated, experimented upon without their knowledge and so on. That has had a profound effect on anything to do in particular with human beings, that it's very, you know, the ethical hoops you have to jump through are enormous now, quite rightly so. And I think that's not entirely around the world, but pretty much. So that has changed. On the other hand, thinking about developing a new form of life, well, it varies. So some of the synthetic biology community have been extremely concerned about it. The mirror life people. So mirror life is this science fiction idea, but it could be real. So, you know, all molecules, organic molecules have a handedness, right? And basically it would be making molecules with the other handedness. So they would not interact with our molecules. It would be a form of life that, for example, could not be detected by our immune system.
Chirality, is that what you're talking about? Like the...
Yeah. So with opposite chirality, every molecule, you would build it the other way around. And then the idea, I mean, this is just an idea at the moment, you would eventually, you know, jumpstart a cell, which would itself be built of opposite chirality molecules, and produce mirror life. Right. So it's a mirror form of everything that has lived for 4 point something billion years. Now, that is pretty terrifying, I think. And the researchers who are primarily engaged in this, earlier this year, they published a long article in Science calling basically for one, for people to stop, to not do this, not create life. Yes, you can carry on. Because it's possible that you could develop particular drugs. So one molecule that you might inject into your body might be perhaps a way of attacking bacteria or viruses, because they wouldn't recognize it either, right? Because it'd be the opposite chirality. So maybe there's some way of preserving biochemical function without triggering responses from those microorganisms. But they argued very strongly that there should be no attempt to actually create mirror life. So that, I think, was a very sensible thing to do in there. The community has actually... they're having a series of meetings in which they're discussing this. And the problem is controlling all these things, right? I mean, mirror life is a bit difficult. It's really, really hardcore. I mean, that's why it's not real, right? It may never be because it's so complicated. But doing CRISPR, you can do CRISPR in your garage. You know, you can do all sorts of things. And controlling that is much, much harder.
I mean, what you're saying absolutely rings true, because the research group I'm a part of, the synthetic biology research group, iGEM, it's an international competition, right? And so everybody is doing, for example, or a lot of teams are doing CRISPR related work. Their whole goal is engineering biology.
Yeah.
And this happens at the level of, we're undergrads. There's high school students who are getting into this. Everyone who gets into this talks about the ethics and are like, yes, of course, we must be ethical. We must consider the social implications of what we're doing.
I think what I would do would be to ensure that everybody has to take a course in both the history and ethics of not only engineering life, which is a pretty kind of weird thing to think about, but also in what happens in technology, what happens, you know. I think that brings in the other point, is that I suspect a lot of people's ethics would disappear into their drawer at the first sign of a stonking check from some venture capitalist.
I mean, to be fair, that big check, but also these tensions seem to be exacerbated by the pressure to publish. Like you all hear a lot, the bullying us into bad science, that kind of talk. And I was wondering, both in your field and on the fields that you've written about, if you've seen how these pressures affect you and your peers. And
well, yeah, I mean, I remember this happened. So it's 10 years after Asilomar. Very quickly after Asilomar, scientists who were involved in it started complaining that people no longer presented their data at conferences, for example.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, they would be very cagey. Sometimes even they wouldn't even talk to the same people in the same lab. And I remember, so this, you know, I'm studying Drosophila, and this was I can't remember what it was about now, some paper on Drosophila development. I wasn't interested in it. Somebody was giving a talk at Cold Spring Harbor, and they refused to present some sequence data, because in those days people would put up a sequence and people would start scribbling it down madly. We didn't have phones in those days. You couldn't take pictures of the screen. So you had to start desperately trying to copy that down. And there were lots of stories that people would deliberately introduce errors into their sequence so that competitors would not be able to compete with them, would go down a blind alley. Now, that's all produced. That's not in a world where there was any money involved. This is simply prestige, the pressure to get a job, to get tenure, to get those glam mag publications. And that's the real tough world we're in. And academia is a kind of Ponzi scheme where we produce lots and lots of graduate students and lots of postdocs, but there aren't the jobs to go with it, because people like me aren't dying. I mean, I've retired, right? But in the US, I'd still be going, and I'd be occupying a lab space because I could. I mean, here you don't have to leave, but you know, it's not the done thing. So there is huge pressure on individual scientists to succeed, and that is massive pressure and causes people to behave in inappropriate ways. But I thought it was fascinating thinking about this a few years ago when I was writing the book, that I recalled this behavior had leached into a field that was had no financial implications whatsoever, but the same thing was going on. People weren't, and very few leading scientists now present their latest data. The past was a completely different country. So Sydney Brenner, right, Francis Crick's best mate, he and Crick decided in about 1963, so this is before all the genetic code has been deciphered, that basically the glory days of molecular biology are over. We found all the key stuff. We know how genes work. We know how proteins are synthesized. We need to find a new field where people aren't getting interested. So they both decided, they had a lot of thought, and what Brenner decided to do was to study development in particular. And he chose this tiny little roundworm called C. elegans. He did not publish an article for 10 years on that work. So he carried on doing it. He was supported by the Medical Research Council in the UK. They employed him. He didn't have lectures to give or, you know, exams to mark or any of that stuff. And he just carried on doing his thing. And it took a whole decade for him to actually have his first publication. That is impossible, including the MRC. They would not allow that. Long-term people thinking, coming up with an idea and following it through. And that's a problem to do with financial constraints, but also the large number of people we've been training, which is fantastic because we get lots and lots of very talented people and brilliant new ideas. But it has this downside. You know, there's a negative consequence to what looks like a positive side.
I think now more than ever, we're realizing that it's not necessarily the who behind scientific discoveries that can make all the difference anymore. There's so many other factors. That's why science communication is so important. And I think using history and storytelling in that sense can really bring a lot of people on board. Speaking to, let's say, my peers who aren't in STEM, let's say, they have trouble understanding the importance of foundational research sometimes, or things that don't necessarily have a very direct application. So it's incredible to use historical facts to have them see it from a different perspective. So I think that's great.
Yeah, I mean, if you want an example on that, there's been a lot of people now emphasizing this because, I mean, it's not new. You know, PCR, everybody knows about PCR because of the pandemic. The only reason that they were able to get that work in the mid-1970s was because they came up with the idea, but they needed an enzyme that could function at incredibly high temperatures. And they went and they found that somebody in 1965 had isolated a thermophilus aquaticus, it's called, TAC, this bacterium from Yellowstone, from one of the hot springs. So it lives at about 95 degrees. It's got it's an extremophile, it's got this astonishing adaptation. And that was just some weird bacteriologist who went rummaging for it, right? Mm-hmm. And if that weird bacteriologist had not discovered that, just think, oh, this is weird, then PCR would not exist because you couldn't engineer an enzyme that could withstand those high temperatures. And they knew that it must work because the bacterium lives in this very hot environment. So clearly they've got some way of doing it. Let's find it, let's extract it, and the polymerase that they needed, and then they could make it work. Similarly, obviously, with CRISPR, that only came about because people were studying, the handful of people, about five or six people in the late 90s, were studying these sequences, these weird sequences in some bacteria. That one of them discovered because he was doing a PhD student, Molina, his name was, he was in Alicante in Spain, and in the area above the university, there's a big salt lake, and he was very interested in these halophilic bacteria, and he sequenced bits of them, and he noticed there were these repetitive bits in there, and he and a handful of other people then looked around, and thought, oh, there's quite a lot of them. That turned out to be, and they coined the name for CRISPR. Which is why CRISPR doesn't mean anything when you explain it to people, what the words mean. Can they go, and it describes a sequence phenomenon. Yeah, but it doesn't actually tell you anything else because they didn't know what it was. It was just this thing. They could see it. They wanted to give it a sexy name. They thought of calling it Spider. We came as close as this to it being Spider. And then they decided that CRISPR was a bit sexy. I can't remember what Spider for. Same kind of thing, right? But all that is 10, 15 years before Dowden and Charpentier are able to show that it can be used with guide RNA to make targeted changes in DNA that are heritable. So, you know, and again, these are fundamental, just people finding things out because they're curious, and it has knock-on consequences. Alexander Fleming, let's go back to him, was not looking for an antibiotic. It was an accident.
What's super interesting is the scientific discovery, obviously everybody remembers, but it's also the who behind the scientific discoveries, although they might not have been, as you said, the first or the person who discovered the bacteria that was responsible, like for TAC. And so just tying it a bit back to earlier, what you talked about, luck in your scientific career, and also a bit to your lecture that you're going to be having in June. I was wondering if now the question of who does science is becoming increasingly relevant, or perhaps not as much so as we move forward in the future of.
Well, I think it is. I mean, so what I am is this, the title of my lecture, which will be available online, is something like the Life and Times of Francis Crick, or Does It Matter Who Does Science? Now, Crick's view was very much that what really counted was the discovery and not the individuals who were involved in it. And that's partly because he was a very private man and didn't particularly like people. I've written a biography of him, so I've been going against his wishes, you know, rummaging around in his his private life. which I felt a bit bad about often. But he was very much felt that it was the discovery, not the individual. And he shirked, especially from about the 70s, early 70s onwards, the last half of his life. He avoided, he shunned publicity of any kind. He talked about his work, but nothing else. He wasn't one of these Nobelists who would make pronouncements on, you know, world peace or all the other stuff that, you know, you got a Nobel Prize. Tell us about your views about AI. Well, I only know about molecular biology, but blah, blah, blah. You know, the kind of stuff that, oh, you know about AI, tell us about CRISPR. Or you know about AI, tell us about the origin of COVID. Well, I don't know. Anyway, he wasn't like that. I think it does matter who does science. I mean, to some extent. So you can see this partly from Crick's own life. So the discovery, I once asked Jim Watson, I said, what was the most important thing you ever did in your life? And he said, well, first thing he said, well, not the double helix. Because the double helix was inevitable. Somebody was going to find it. If we didn't, then Franklin did, or Wilkins or Pauling. Somebody was going to find it because it was just sitting there. The data were there. One, you then just had to, as they did, put in 4 or 5 weeks hard model building, fiddling around with bits of basic the rules of organic chemistry, and it would fall out because it was a relatively simple structure. And you just had to kind of be smart and persist. And that was inevitably going to happen. And you can see that in what I was fascinated by. So Crick works with Watson, they discover the double helix, but straight away, so that's not important in a way, who did that, I don't think. I mean, we can draw all sorts of lessons about how it happened, but what's really important, what's Crick's real contribution, was what happened afterwards. So one of the things about the double helix is that you can look at it and you straight away know two things: how it works, how it can reproduce itself because you've got reciprocal pairs of bases, and secondly, how it encodes genetic information. Either sequence of bases is basically infinite. And those two, the first article Watson Crick wrote just mentions the first thing, just mentions replication, doesn't deal with real function because replication is boring, right? The key thing is the information. That appears in the second Nature article they published 6 weeks later, which was written entirely by Crick, which is all about the idea of genetic information. And I wrote a whole book about that idea and how it goes on to become the basis of the work on the genetic code. And it's very striking that throughout the 1950s, none of the other clever people who were involved in this, Wilkins, Franklin, Watson, or any of the other people, really thought hard about the implications of the structure for evolutionary biology, for how genes work, for the nature of the genetic code. That was Crick and virtually alone, just thinking and talking and reading the data and arguing with people. And that is an astonishing, you know, had he not done it, then those things would have been discovered, but nowhere near as quickly and probably not as elegantly. And not as in such a condensed, concise way. The whole thing basically was resolved by 1965, 1966. We had the whole genetic code. We knew about messenger RNA and so on. And so that, I think, shows you that individuals can make a difference. Now, I think that's much harder these days, especially in the biosciences, because it's all big teams, right? And I was very struck. Crick wrote a book about, because he got very interested in neuroscience, and he wrote a book about the consciousness and the how brains work, which is basically a basic neuroscience book, basically saying consciousness is a material phenomenon. This came out in 1994. Huge hullabaloo, massive things in, you know, events in London, you know, articles in the Times of London comparing him to Mozart. I mean, quite extravagant things. Huge editorial in Nature. And it just struck me that it's hard to imagine any single scientist getting that kind of, for a popular scientist, any science. You know, nowadays, we have science communicators, Brian Cox, other people. They are not talking about their particular area of expertise. They're scientists, but they're primary communicators. So times have very much changed, partly because biological science has become so complicated. So you need to have lots of people on your team. And that's shifted an awful lot, I think, over the last few decades. The same in physics, you know, with CERN. They have, I don't know how many hundreds of people on a paper from CERN, you know, whereas Peter Higgs, who wrote the thing, you know, was the sole author on a paper that led to that, right? So that's the kind of change we've seen, I think.
I mean, I think in a way also because there's much more cross-pollination between disciplines, these bigger teams seem even bigger because there's a lot of collaboration, which I think is really exciting. Although the days of a single author or two authors on a paper are very, very
Yeah,
much
they're very rare
not
these
there
days.
anymore. But no, I think there's a lot to look forward to and a lot to pay attention, be careful about in the life sciences today and tomorrow. It was great speaking to you, Professor Cobb, to learn about the history, the present, and now a bit the future of where we're going in all of this. I can't thank you enough, and I hope our listeners can take a lot away as much as I did from our conversation.
Well, I hope people enjoyed it. It was great talking to you. Look after yourself. And I hope you enjoy reading and listening to the various things that are on the reading list.